got the horse right here. The name is Paul Revere. And here's the guy that says if the weather's clear, can do, can do. This guy says the horse can do.
Now you haven't stumbled on a production of Guys and Dolls. We're talking this hour. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, talking this hour about the Triple Crown. You know, it's here, horse racing, the second leg. The Preakness is set for next week at Pimlico. And so what better time than now to talk about the science of horse racing? And in case you missed the race last week, let me bring you up to date. It was a classic rags-to-riches tale. A colt named Smarty Jones raced into fame last week with a heart-pounding win at the Kentucky Derby, running down Lionheart in the final furlong at Churchill Downs. Ironically, though, the winner may not have the most impressive breeding, but he certainly can run. So what does? You know, we all talk about horse racing and breeding, and, well, what does make a great racehorse if it's not only about putting together the right mix of genetics to produce a perfectly bred foal? What other essential ingredients make for a winner? How much do sports medicines and drugs fit in? Is it biology and chemistry that determine who wins? Maybe it's all about the desire, right? The desire to win. Can a horse really have a desire to win? How do you know? Can you get inside a horse's psyche like you can inside a human athlete's brain and learn how to motivate the horse to win? Can you motivate a horse to win? Are there sports psychologists for horses? You know, maybe you saw that. Maybe that movie, The Horse Whisperer. I don't know. Is that real? That's what we're going to talk about this hour. Horse racing, the science of horse racing. And if you'd like to join in our discussion, give us a call. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guests. Scott Waterman is a veterinarian by training and the executive director of the Racing Medication and Testing Consortium in Lexington, Kentucky. He joins us by phone from his office there. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Waterman.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Norm Ducharme is a professor of surgery and the medical director of the Equinan Farm Animal Hospitals at Cornell University's College of Veterinary Medicine. He joins us from the studios on the campus there in Ithaca. Welcome, Dr. Ducharme.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, too.
Thank you. Niall Brennan trains young thoroughbreds at the Niall Brennan Stables, and he is one of the leading U.S. racehorse consigners. He's joining us by phone from his farm in Ocala, Florida. Welcome to the show, Mr. Brennan.
Thank you.
Thank you. Norm Ducharme, what is it about horses that make them such great athletes?
Well, it's hard to know all the physiological reason why they're so gifted for speed. There's a large part of genetic that plays a role as far as how they've been designed through the years and careful breeding such that their muscle is so well developed and their joint are so in tune with moving a horse from point A to point B at a fairly high speed. The lungs and heart plays an important role, and I mean here physiological heart, not the mind when someone talks about the heart or mm-hmm. you referred earlier on. The lungs are actually what limits the performance the most. They're not able to maintain the level of oxygen that they need to race at full speed for a long period of time, mm-hmm. but their musculoskeletal system is very well built.
Mm-hmm. Do they process energy very well to make them, you know, go fast?
They process energy, and different breed and different horse do that differently. It depends mm-hmm. whether the horse or racehorse, as we're talking about here, to an endurance horse that will have a different storage of energy, and they're a big role into how horses perform is also the feeding, the nutrition, and the trainers that can detect that this horse does better with this program versus that mm-hmm. program, because mm-hmm. not all horse fit the same program.
Niall Brennan, let's help you help us take us back into the life cycle of a horse. Would it be fair to say you were like a racehorse talent scout?
Well, that's one way to describe it. We do spend a lot of time a lot of footwork at the sales, looking for the young talent that we can hopefully fit into our budget and purchase and bring them down here to Florida where we start the breaking and training process and in the hopes of getting the next young superstars.
So you essentially teach a horse, a young horse, how to be a racehorse.
Well, I don't know that we teach them how to be a racehorse. I mean, I think we try to enhance their natural ability by doing everything we can to develop them properly and give them every chance to be the best they can be. But, I mean, I don't artificially create ability.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine pedigree then is one of the most important traits you look for.
Yes, definitely. Years ago, pedigree was probably the number one factor in valuing the horses. Where probably in recent years, there's been a shift to more emphasis on conformation and athleticism. But certainly pedigree factors into to what you want.
Conformation meaning what to we non-horse people?
Well, just how the horse is built. If he's size and scope and certainly balance and the way that his conformation, his legs, if they're straight or crooked, maybe through the knees. Not indifferent to humans. If you're standing there and there's certain people that are very slim and fit looking versus people that are out of shape. You're trying to look for that athlete.
Right. Scott Waterman, or I'll let anybody answer this question. What makes, training a horse, of course, the obvious that the horse can't talk to you, I guess, in the same way that a human does. What makes training a horse different than, let's say, training somebody for the mile run in the Olympics? What kind of difference is there?
Well, I think somebody might be better suited to answer that question, maybe Mr. Brennan, than I.
Okay, I'll ask Niall.
Well, you're talking about the difference in sprinting or distance running?
Well, yeah, in distance running. I mean, how do you train a horse differently? And I'm trying to compare it to people. How do you train a horse differently to run for, say, a mile than a person would train an athlete to run for a mile?
The basics of conditioning would be similar. I mean, I think people even in the horse business training have garnered a lot of information from from human athletics. People, for example, the Olympic sprinters, Olympic athletes in track and field, the sprinters do a lot of sprint training, obviously, and conditioning and weight training, whereas the marathon runners do a lot of long, slow running. Maybe they run 5 or 10 miles every single day. They don't do very little sprint work. They do just a lot of conditioning work. Horses are very much the same. The horses that are built like quarter horses, for example, that are very stocky and very muscular and built for speed are going to do a lot of short, quick work and short, quick, fast work, whereas horses with a lot bigger, scopier outlook are going to do a lot longer, slower gallops every day to build their endurance and their stamina.
How do you get inside, a horse's head? Does a horse have to be motivated to perform its best? I mean, is there horse psychology that you use on a horse?
I think there probably is some psychology to some degree. I mean, it depends on who you talk to. I think, horses come in different shapes and sizes and different personalities. They're just like teenagers. Some are rebellious and some are really are very good. And I think you just have to give and take. You certainly can't treat them all the very same. I think we try to feel like we custom design our programs to try and develop each horse's ability to the best we can. Mm-hmm.
Scott Waterman, when I asked a horse enthusiast the other day, an expert, he said that drugs in horse racing is one of the biggest issues in all of horse racing.
I think that is probably an accurate perception, and it's one of the reasons the industry works as hard as it can to control medication and drugs as much as it possibly can.
What kind of drugs do horses get normally?
Well, I think certainly they get what I would call therapeutic medications. They are individual creatures. They are athletes, and from time to time, medications are certainly necessary to diagnose and treat illness or injury, and that comes with the territory of being an athlete in training. So typically things like non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, aspirins, if you will, of the horse. There are also medications that are designed to help the horse breathe. I believe we heard earlier that they're limited by their respiratory tract. Horses tend to get viruses, head colds, if you will, since they are stabled in close proximity. Viruses tend to float around barns. So those are the type of therapeutic medications that we'll often see.
Yeah, we heard last week, speaking of that, we heard last week that all the Derby horses except for one, for a Lionheart, were given a diuretic drug called Lasix, which is a very common drug even for people, before the race for a problem with bleeding in the lungs. Tell us about this bleeding in the lungs issue.
The actual name of the condition is exercise-induced pulmonary hemorrhage, and it appears to be part of being a horse. They are flight animals. You've heard the terminology fight or flight. Well, they're flight. They run away. That's what they do. And because of that, their physiology is built to try to make that happen as efficiently as possible. So what happens when a horse has a nice little burst of adrenaline release, they dump a tremendous number of red blood cells into the circulation. There are tremendous increases in blood pressure. And because of that, tiny, tiny little capillaries in the lungs can't take that additional pressure, and some will burst. And that will actually lead to hemorrhage in the lungs. The diuretic Lasix, furosemide is the generic name, has been given since probably late 60s, early 70s to try to manage that bleeding in the lungs. The furosemide has an effect of lowering that blood pressure throughout the circulation of the lungs and thereby reducing the amount of bleeding.
So it doesn't hurt the horse in any way?
No, it doesn't. It's actually a pretty harmless medication. Now, again, horses are all individuals, and as individuals, some will react better to medications than others, and there are some horses that react poorly to Lasix, and they're typically not given it before the race.
Does the horse get any kind of physical after the race?
Yeah, typically the horse will get a physical. In a lot of cases, horses are also scoped via a fiber optic endoscope after the race.
You mean like a stethoscope with a little fiber optic cable on it?
It's actually a long, flexible tube that's actually passed via the nostril down into the trachea, and you can actually get fairly far down to see whether or not there's mucus or blood in the airways.
And that would be because of the problem with the bleeding?
You're looking for a reason to explain why a horse may not have performed up to the level that you thought he would.
Because they could just stop doing what they should be doing right in mid-race.
That's right.
Yeah. And would every horse be getting that exam after it, or only when something unexpected happens?
It depends probably in a large number of cases on the trainer and what their typical pattern is, and also, too, on the owner, because the owner is the one that ends up having to pay that bill.
I read you now. Okay. We're going to take a short break and come back. Take your questions. We're talking with Scott Waterman, Norm Ducharme, and Niall Brennan about horse racing this week before the second leg of the Triple Crown. If you have questions about the science of horse racing and you always wanted to ask somebody a question on it, here's a good opportunity to get it off your mind. So stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the science in horse racing and how science is applied to horse racing. We've been talking with Scott Waterman, Norm Ducharme, and Niall Brennan. I want to bring on, for a brief bit of time that he has to talk with us, Patrick Biancone, who is trainer of Lionheart, runner-up in this year's Kentucky Derby. And he has a history of success in racing, having twice won France's premier race, the Arc de Triomphe. Joins us now from Keeneland Racetrack in Lexington. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Thank you to invite me.
Thank you for joining us. How do you think that Lionheart performed last week?
I think he performed great. You know, I mean, like I said, we had the silver medal. We'd have preferred the gold, but it was a great race. And they have to run so many climate environment, you know, and this big thunderstorm before will change a bit the face of the race, but he handled it well, and we were very proud of him.
Can you, we were trying to talk a little bit more about understanding how a horse thinks a bit. Can you actually understand what's, you know, the mood and the attitude of Lionheart?
You know, I think race horses are real athletes, you know, and like people who do sport understand, and you can be extremely talented, but at the top level is a mental who makes a difference, and you know, these great champions, racehorse or human athletes, the mental is everything, I would say.
So how do you get the horse, how do you get Lionheart psyched up or ready for the race? Or can you not do that? That's up to him to, you know, get himself ready.
I mean, just as the trainer of the Lakers, or you bring Shaq O'Neal at the best for the playoff, you know, for the same reason. And, I mean, we all train athletes, and we... You know, I mean, it's we know how to do. And, mm-hmm. I mean, maybe very long to explain, but it's just to bring the horse the best is possible in the best form possible. And normally, when they're physically in a great form, the mental follow. You know.
Yeah. So, how much of horse racing is an art, would you say, and how much of it is a science?
Well, it's a mix of both. I don't know. I mean, I never asked myself this question. You know, I'm born in this. I do that since I'm 12, and you know, I'm 52 and. I've never asked myself the question. I just try to see the athletes I have in under my control and try to do what I think is the best for them. And hopefully, most of the time we are right, and sometimes we are wrong, but we don't talk too much about it. You know.
So if I ask you what kind of strategy you're going to have for the next race, you're not going to tell me too much.
But you know, I mean, I don't think I'm going to put the strategy in the newspaper or on the live talk radio. You know, but. The first thing is to try, you know, at least when you have to run again after a big race like that, 2 weeks later, 14 days later, it's more a question. The horses are fit, they're in great form, and it just must more a question of how they recover from the Derby effort. And all our work these days with Lionheart is to try to make him digest the Derby as soon as possible and the best he can, and hopefully if he... All the parameters are good next week. I mean, we will go for the Preakness, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Preakness is a shorter race than the Derby, and Lionheart likes to lead from the start. Do you think he's better suited for that distance in the Preakness?
I mean, you know, he's only 100 yards. You know, it's not a big deal of a difference. But I don't think before the Derby, I was, like everybody, not knowing exactly if he can stay the trip, but I think he has no problem with that. I mean, if he was beaten at the Derby, it's not because of the trip, it's because on the day he find a horse who is exceptional and who beat us fair and square. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I mean, the only, if you have a regret, you know, the only regret you have is to be born the same year as Smalley Jones, you know? The only regret you can have, but, you know, we have lose the first leg. We are going to be a challenger and try to come back and try to get back on him, you know?
Well, I wish you the best of luck next week.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for joining us. Patrick Biancone is trainer of Lionheart and trying to take that second round leg of the Triple Crown. We're talking also with Scott Waterman, executive director of Racing Medication and Testing Consortium in Lexington. Norm Ducharme, professor of surgery and medical director of the Equine and Farm Animal Hospitals at Cornell University's College of Veterinary Medicine. And Niall Brennan, trainer of young thoroughbreds at the Niall Brennan Stables in Ocala, Florida. It's one of the leading racehorse consigners. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Lots of people want to talk racing. No betting allowed today. Paula in North Carolina. Hi, Paula. Welcome to Science Friday. Let's go to Roy in Boise. Roy, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. I was curious, before a race starts, there's odds set for the different horses, and I imagine it takes into account recent races and how they... performed in training and what kind of jockey or who the jockey is on them. But what factors are used to develop those odds? When the betting starts, the odds change, you know, immensely. But there seems to be some art or science or something involved in that initial step of setting them up.
Let me ask Niall, do you have any idea how the odds are set?
Well, it's probably mostly on form. You have the racing form or a program, if you like, at every racetrack, and it has the horse's most recent form. And there's different handicapping forms, such as buyer numbers, which where a horse is given a number for every race that tracks. It's a standard number for each racetrack to kind of grade how good their last race was. So when the odds come out, basically it's looking at the horses with the best form that look like the best horses, and then from there the crowd basically make the favorite in the par mutual betting. The more money that's placed on a certain horse lowers the odds to where that horse will be the favorite.
All right, thanks for calling. 1-800-989-8255. Let's see if this time I can get Paula in North Carolina. Hi, Paula.
Yes, hello.
Hi there.
Hi. I'm responding to your question about psychology with horses.
Yes.
I was Saddle Slew's first trainer.
Wow.
And there's a lot of, I would say that it's more than 50% psychology. Really good training, and I would say yes, there is an art to it.
Well, how do you put the horse on your couch, so to speak?
Well, if the horse is sent to me from the start, it's a heck of a lot easier than if I'm remaking a horse that's been literally psychologically messed up. If I'm starting one from scratch, for one thing, you pass on your own confidence with the horse. Horses feel vibrations in the air. They can pick up whether you're afraid, whether you're confident, whether you're courageous. So it's really important to be confident working around them. And it's also important to never overface the horse. Like children in school, you have to build a strong foundation, only move forward one step at a time. And if the horse has trouble with the next step, be able to recognize that, and instead of punishing them, back up, go over the last lesson until it's easy, and then move forward again.
Hmm.
And it should be easy for them. You have to find ways for them to have fun, to make their work fun. Now, that's with a horse that I'm starting from scratch. Many, many times I've sent horses to be remade.
Right.
Just like people had some psychological trauma or another, they don't want to run anymore. They're just really miserable. And that takes at least three times longer than starting a horse from scratch.
Are there any horse Prozac sort of things, you know, that we give to people?
If there are, I don't use them. No, it's a matter of taking a lot of time with the horse and basically teaching that horse to have confidence in himself. Again, it comes from you, but it really takes a lot of time and patience. You have to be able to recognize what the horse needs and teach the horse to believe in himself.
That's right.
Basically, the base that will be the basis of, you know, whenever a horse is messed up, he doesn't believe in himself anymore.
Just like any great athlete.
Any great athlete, and you know, people go to therapists all the time, and this is very similar to therapy that people would undergo.
Well, thank you, Paula, for taking time to talk with us. Very interesting.
You're quite welcome.
Good luck to you. 1-800-989-8255. We're talking about horse racing this hour. Scott Waterman, what about this issue of steroids in racing? I mean, we talk about steroids in baseball now. It's out there. Is it illegal to use it in racing?
Actually, the anabolic steroids sort of fall into what I would call a gray area in terms of how they're regulated. Excuse me. They're they're problematic from a regulatory standpoint because anabolic steroids tend to last in a horse's system sometimes upwards to 60 days after a single dose, meaning a laboratory can detect it for that long of a period of time after a single dose. In most cases, anabolic steroids are used with horses at the track, not to build muscle mass as they are on the human athletic side. They, in fact, building additional muscle mass beyond what the horse is physiologically slated to carry may actually be counterproductive. They're sort of finely tuned creatures, and if you get them that far out of tune, you're asking for problems. In most cases, anabolic steroids are given maybe once a month, maybe once every other month, maybe once every 6 months, maybe never. Typically, in order to build muscle mass, anabolic steroids need to be given routinely, like every week for a period of time. Mm-hmm. So the dosages are not the types that are going to build muscle mass. They're more used as sort of a general tonic, almost like an elixir. Keep a horse's attitude good, keep them in training, keep them cleaning out their feed bucket every night. They're typically not used as they are on the human side of the equation.
So when I said, is there Prozac for horses? This is sort of like that, then, keeping their attitude
tuned degree.
Up. Yeah,
to a degree.
Interesting. What other kinds of drugs do horses get?
Well, as I said, we sort of view things in the racing world as therapeutic versus non-therapeutic. Mm-hmm. The therapeutic side of the equation, usually you're talking about the non-steroidals to help with the musculoskeletal
right.
system, respiratory type agents. Racing, in fact, has taken sort of the pharmacopoeia and divided it up into five separate categories, 1 through 5. One being drugs that are not therapeutic at all to the horse, that have a high potential to influence performance, to class 5, which are therapeutic drugs that are not going to influence performance. Mm-hmm. And we sort of view all drugs in terms of those five categories.
Mm-hmm. Let's say we can get a quick phone call in here before the break. Let's go to Lynn in Lake Tahoe, California. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. Well, this has to do with your statement about do horses wish to win. I've grown up with horses and owned several in my life, and I've seen them demonstrate this, the best of which was in Central America, 5 horses, all mature, the oldest of which I think was 12, 2 stallions and, 3 stallions, 2 geldings, wide dirt road at night, only starlight, it was very dark, and these horses, we were walking them back from town, and the horses on their own staged a race, and they went all out. We weren't ginging them up. We were just holding on. And each was vying with the others, and these old horses did everything imaginable to be first, and each of them managed at one point to get ahead of the pouch. It was incredible.
Hmm.
And the sound their hooves made, and, you know, there it was at night, all of us slightly barracho, not believing what we were experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, they do want to win. And these were not thoroughbreds. These were just mm-hmm. large, noble horses.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for calling. It's an interesting story. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking about horse racing, the science of it, this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Of course, Niall, you're going to be looking for a horse that wants to run, right?
Well, hopefully we pick the right ones, yeah.
Yeah. Can you tell pretty quickly after you've bought a horse or looked at one whether it's that kind of horse?
I think so, fairly. Well, you know, within a few months, I think you see the right, the natural athletes, you know, stick out. I mean, they're just natural ability and their attitude and their temperament, you know, those ones do stick out very early, and mm-hmm. other horses are just a little slower to mature. I mean, I would, working with young horses specifically, I don't ever give up on them too soon. But some of them just develop at different stages.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Sherry in Lawrence, Kansas. Hi, Sherry.
Hi.
Hi there.
I breed warm blood horses, and everybody in the sport horse business kind of shakes their head at the thought of racing 2-year-olds. We don't even back our babies till they're 2, or even work them till they're 3. Because we're worried about the joints. And I'm just wondering if there have been any conclusive studies on racing 2-year-olds, and the effect of these tremendous concussions on, like, the carpus and the hock and the stifle. It just seems like that's a lot of work for an immature body.
And Norm Ducharme?
Yeah, it does seem like a lot of work for a young horse. However, times have changed in the last 15 years. The tracks are better. The concussion that their horse experience while running is diminished by better track, better footing. The shoeing is better. And a lot of more medication are given, we call chondroprotectin, which are medication to protect the joints. It is difficult to have studies to compare what a horse would do as a two-year-old if he was exercised versus a five-year-old's, mm-hmm. because there are no control. There's no doubt that the injury rate, which is mainly musculoskeletal in racehorses, is quite elevated. However, I know personally one trainer that decided that he would delay the training of his horses so they wouldn't hurt their shin, which is a common injury to young horses, and wouldn't have fractures. Chip fractures are fairly common in young horses. And he delayed training till he was five. There's a few effect of that, but then these horses that start running for the first time at five experience the same injuries as a two-year-old did. They just did it 2 years later. Mm. The practical implication is also significant, as the purse money is in the young horses. And so the business does not encourage that type of of training or thinking. But to my knowledge, there are no data showing that waiting a few more years makes a significant difference on the rate of injury, although it does so individually. Young horses may not be ready to run as a two-year-old, mm-hmm. especially the larger horse. They need more maturing to occur and may not be ready till they're three.
All right. All right, I'm going to have to break in. We'll come back and talk about this, because I want to talk about why arbitrarily is a two-year-old pick, why is 2 years old picked to be the training, you know, time you run the horses. So what is that in human age, two-year horse years? We'll find out. Stay with us. I'm Ira Flatto, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. We're talking this hour about the science of racehorsing with my guest, Scott Waterman, Executive Director of the Racing Medication and Testing Consortium in Lexington, Kentucky. Norm Ducharme, Professor of Surgery and Medical Director of the Equine and Farm Animal Hospitals at Cornell's College of Veterinary Medicine. Niall Brennan, trainer of young thoroughbreds at the Niall Brennan Stables in Ocala, Florida. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Well, maybe I'll ask you, Niall, what is a two-year-old in human years?
Well, good question. I guess it depends on who you ask. what is it? Dog years is supposed to be one for every seven.
Right.
I'm not sure what it is in horses, to be quite honest, but it's probably something similar.
Uh-huh.
They do develop a lot, obviously, a lot quicker than humans.
And why is the 2 years old chosen as the time to race them in such a way?
Well, I think it's probably developed. I mean, you know, going back to even your earlier question about the horses racing so young. I mean, we go back to the movie Seabiscuit, which probably many of your listeners have seen. And Seabiscuit himself raced in the 30s, and he ran 26 times as a two-year-old. Today, I imagine even today's racing, the two-year-olds average probably six or seven starts for their two-year-old year. Mm-hmm. So it's really not that unusual. We've been doing this for many, many years. Their speed is a desire in any sport. It doesn't matter if it's football, basketball, NASCAR, the development of NASCAR. People love speed, and in horse racing, it's just as desirable. Fast horses are what people want. They develop very quickly. Some two-year-olds are very mature, very early, and they're. Believe it or not, they're well able to handle the rigors of what we put them through. That doesn't mean every horse is. There's certain that are not ready to run as two-year-olds, and usually the trainers that are good horsemen are able to spot that, and they just give them more time.
We used to see all the time in racing over the last decades. The horses would be, you know, put down. They'd be killed for just breaking a bone or something like that. Do they still do that that often, or for injuries? We would say, hey, you know, just patch them up and put them out the pasture.
Well, I think unfortunately, when a horse during a race or training, if they have a catastrophic injury, it's just not possible to repair those kind of injuries. Horses, horses can't have a cast on necessarily. They can't stand. If they shatter a leg, it's just irreparable. I'm sure Dr. Waterman might be able to answer that better from a physiological standpoint, but it's very difficult to rehab those horses, let alone repair the actual catastrophic injury. Mm-hmm. They're athletes. They just can't withstand that.
Norm Scott, any comment?
Actually, I'll jump in and say that one of the biggest problems is that, again, if you think about a horse and that leg being so thin, when there is a catastrophic injury, the blood circulation is disrupted. And without that blood supply, you can't have healing. So that's one of the big problems. Another problem is that if you try to put a cast on a horse, they tend to overcompensate with the other leg. And that can lead to a condition called laminitis, which can affect the hoof on the opposite side of where the fracture is. So they're just very difficult animals to deal with post-operatively and operatively.
Mm-hmm. In this age, this new world of genetic engineering, is it possible to just do away with the slow, you know, breeding process? Could we just genetically modify the traits that we'd like and choose them that way in a petri dish? Is the industry heading in that direction, do you think?
Well, I hope not. That would take a lot of the art out of the game, and I don't know that anybody wants to see that. And I think, too, from the standpoint of regulating a sport that is dependent on parimutuel wagering, that's not something that we would want to see at all. Similar to, you know, that they're tossing around this issue on the Olympics as well, Olympic athletes and gene doping. It's something that certainly we would not want to see in our sport.
Mm-hmm. Scott, weigh in on that?
Jump in. Certainly the genomic studies and the gene therapy may help perhaps more in the repair of certain injury, to be able to program the horse to be more, to repair his cartilage if he or she has undergo some kind of either tendon injury or cartilage injury and so forth. And so the therapy phase of this is probably where the science will go more rapidly than starting to play, let me put the speed gene into this one and not tell the trainer.
I see. Norm, the horse gene hasn't been fully deciphered yet, has he?
But there are many groups throughout the world that are working on them, including here at Cornell University, and they're mapping it, but it's not fully mapped for sure.
And this would be more for therapeutic mapping?
Yeah, there are a lot of ethical and practical issue as far as playing with the gene. But for therapy, for instance, horses that undergo certain smaller fracture in their joints, the cartilage needs to heal. And cartilage traditionally does not heal well at all. And could you manipulate the gene such that you can enhance healing of that tissue, for instance? And so those would be an example. The fractures, although the catastrophic fracture are hard to repair, some of them are repairable. But perhaps if we can make calcium become deposits so that you get what we call a callus at the fracture site much quicker, we might be able to save more horses.
Do people talk about cloning horses at all? I mean, if you could get some DNA from Secretariat, you know, try cloning Secretariat, that would be something, wouldn't it?
it would have a whole slew of implication as far as how many of these horses do you clone. There have been some cloning in mules and donkey, I believe, in the UK, and there are issues with that as far as their durability and their aging, how quickly their tissue age compared to normal mules or donkey. I forget which of the two they've used.
Niall, would that wreck the horse business?
Well, I think without a doubt it would. I mean, if you had 20 secretariats running in a race, I mean, what fun would there be anymore? There'd be no art. You'd take the whole art and the horsemanship out of the game. Yeah.
Norm, what was so special about him? I mean, such a horse that ran away from the field, so to speak. What made him such a super horse physically?
Well, he was a large horse, and you would think that that would play a role, that physically he was more like Shaq. Shaq would be to the basketball.
Right.
However, a very small horse, Norton Dancer, was a similarly very dominant horse at his time. So the real answer is we don't know. It's certainly not all size, and the mind plays an important role. But we don't know all the factors.
Didn't they remove his heart to see how big it was when he died? I'd heard that story. Or is that an urban legend?
No, actually, well, I don't think it is. I think they did, and they found that his heart was quite a bit bigger than would be expected for a horse that size. Mm-hmm. And the theory being that, you know, somehow or another his cardiovascular system was so much more efficient. And that's what led to him being a great racehorse. But certainly, I would imagine that you could have a horse with a similar sized heart that doesn't have the right brain for it, and you're not going to get there.
Is there a computer model someplace of the ideal horse and how fast the maximized ideal could run? Anybody, you know, do that kind of modeling, computer modeling, that you're aware of? Some genius in a laboratory someplace in a computer lab?
I'm not aware of any such study or modeling. Mm-hmm. And the speed of the horses have not increased greatly.
That's interesting.
Secretariat still owns the track record.
Talking about horse racing this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. And why would that be? You know, in human racing, the number has been going down. You know, look at Roger Bannister and his mile, you know, so many decades ago, and it's about 15 seconds faster now. Is there something a little different about horses?
Well, there are some people that that study cardiovascular measuring over the last decade at least and have stored all the data. Also stride analysis or gait analysis while horses are in full flight to try and determine what the better horses are, what their qualifications are. But I don't. In my opinion, as a horseman, I think a lot of that it's tools to be used, but there's no definitive answer. That's why it's such a great sport. It's unique. It's nobody can dominate the racehorse business because they're good goods come in small packages, and great horses come in different sizes and shapes. And there's no one dominating factor as to why horses are why the supreme athlete is why he is.
Yeah. If I could give you, I'm going to ask you the blank check question I ask a lot of my guests. If I give you a blank check and you can spend any amount of money to do some research on that, on how to get that better horse, how would you spend it?
How would I spend it?
Yeah. What kind of research would you do? Or is there anything you can, you know, or are you just telling me there's so much of an art to it that the science really, you know, takes a back seat to it?
Yeah, well, I think it is. It is a lot of art and horsemanship as to the people that have shown a track record to be successful in a consistent basis, whether it be trainers or the agents picking the horses. I think there's a great art to that. And those people do keep track of any recent technological advances and try to use those tools in their selection process. But, again, I don't think there's any one determining factor.
Mm-hmm. And, in fact, was it Secretariat has a bloodline on a lot of the horses that are being raced today?
Well, Secretariat himself was not considered a very successful sire when he went to stud. He did have some success, but he was, I guess, with all the expectations, he was disappointing. However, he has been a very successful broodmare sire. In other words, his greatness has been passed on in the next generation through his broodmares. At this point, he's looking that's where his greatness has been passed down.
In general, on a first generation horse, can you tell whether it's the male or the female of the horse that carries more of the traits?
Not really. I think I suppose you just judge the individuals. It's not something that he could still have a bad individual that's born that just doesn't look like an athlete and doesn't have any athletic ability. You're not going to know that right from the word go.
Mm-hmm. How much when we watch Seabiscuit, how much of it do you think was a lot of hogwash? How they portrayed Seabiscuit?
Well, I enjoyed the movie. Yeah. I thought it was wonderful.
It was a great movie,
emotional.
But did it actually convey the truth about horse training?
Well, I think it skipped over it, a lot of things, but it's most people will agree that the book is always better than the movie itself. But the movie can only address so many things in an hour and a half or 2 hours. It did touch on a lot of the subjects in the book, and I thought the book itself was amazing, and it did give a lot of the more insight into the training that went on. But then again, a lot of it was done secretively.
Yeah.
That Tom Smith, the trainer of Seabiscuit, his methods were, he was just a very quiet, quietly spoken horseman that stayed with his horses all day, and he did a lot of things when people weren't around. It was just his unique sense of one with the horse. He was he had a great instinct and a great way with him, and he was able to bring the best out of Seabiscuit.
Well, we've run out of time, but I've certainly enjoyed talking to all of you. I want to thank you both and wish you all good luck, all three of you, in your careers and your horses. Niall Brennan is a trainer of young thoroughbreds at the Niall Brennan Stables in Ocala, Florida. Norman Ducharme is professor of surgery and medical director of the Equine and Farm Animal Hospitals at Cornell University's College of Veterinary Medicine. And Scott Waterman is executive director of the Racing Medication and Testing Consortium in Lexington, Kentucky. And good luck to you all at the Preakness.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Paul Masiello and Rigo Cardi in New York. We also had help from Colbert McClellan in Ithaca. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we did have help today from NPR librarians Kim Oleski and Alphonse Vinn. Brief program note, join guest host Joe Palka on Monday's Talk of the Nation. As always, you can surf over to our website at Science Friday. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flato in New York.
So make it epitaph. He waited by a half, according to this here in the telegraph. Epitaph.
Over there, I got the horse.